Okay, we'll go ahead and get started. What I want to do today is to wrap up the, more or less the lecture portion of the course with some comments about state-of-the-art techniques and systems that use this kind of adaptation we've been discussing in this class. And then next class we'll have a demonstration from our colleagues out at Radiance Technology. They're going to show us this acoustic beamformer that they've built. And then we'll have a final. We'll also spend some time today on course evaluation, so I need a volunteer to hand these out. And one of you two guys. Just hand, hand them out and then return them to the department office. I'll give you about 20 minutes.
How about the final?
How about the final?
Yeah, do you have some details to tell us?
What would you like to know about the final?
The cover. The first half and the second half, the second half of the...
You think it would be hard to get a final exam problem on the second half of the course?
Yeah. It's hard to prepare for that.
Yeah, because we don't have homework problems, right?
Yeah. And there's too many derivations.
Right, and we didn't go through it. The derivations are very long, and so it'd be very difficult to create questions. So that's a challenge. I take that as a challenge. I could do something like give you a simple model and ask you to derive a map estimation algorithm to estimate the parameters.
That's it, first time.
No. Well, not really. We talked about map in great detail in the second half. So, I don't have a good answer. In advanced graduate classes in general, I think it's very hard to get homework problems because the topics you're talking about aren't really amenable. They're more amenable to projects and things. And we had, as I mentioned at the beginning of the semester, there was a if you wanted to work on some special projects, that was fine. Nobody's taken advantage of that yet, and that doesn't surprise me. But sometimes with topics like this, the only good way to learn them is through doing projects where you have to deal with some of the details. The final, I think, we'll probably have on the order of three problems, maybe one from the beginning, first half of the class, one from the second half of the class, and one that sort of bridges all the material in the class. I wouldn't worry about it too much. I would suggest you just study the notes, be familiar with the material, and you should be able to do a reasonable job on the problems. I have not even thought much about what kind of problems I'm going to ask, but I wouldn't worry about the final too much. It's an advanced graduate class. There's more to life than final exams. So I think if you're familiar with the material, not all the details of the derivations, but I think the main thing is to be familiar with the motivation behind each one of the topics, to know what the essence of the topic is. For example, discriminative adaptation versus map adaptation, understanding the difference between those two, and understanding a little bit about how you would go about deriving that algorithm, but not all the details. Does that help? Not much, right? So, as you're studying, feel free to send me emails or give me a call or, any of that, and we can talk. I'll be around through the final. The final, I think, was scheduled for something like December 6th or somewhere in there.
Yeah, December 6th, the Saturday.
It's a Saturday, yeah. What an awful day for final. I have a final, I also have a final December 9th this time, which is, I think, the last day. Don't overstudy for it. Like I said, read the notes. Make sure you're, if I mention a topic, you can sort of tell me. I think a good a good rule of thumb with studying for finals, I feel, is I should be able to ask you about a topic, say, you know, a topic that we talked about in one of the lectures, and you should be able to at least review or describe what we covered about that topic in the course. If you can do that, you'll probably be okay. I usually like to throw in an essay question on the final, because I always like to read your thoughts on the material and how what your perspectives are on the material. So I probably will throw in an essay question just so I can get some sense of if you really understand the philosophy behind the course. But again, I wouldn't worry about the final. I think everyone did pretty well in the midterm, so we should be okay. Okay? So don't overstudy for the final. Okay, so let's talk. I wanted to hit on a couple topics, and I was looking for, to try to put together some material that touched on a number of topics that we haven't really talked about much. I wanted to talk about language model adaptation, because that's an interesting application of adaptation that's, again, it's certainly somewhat specific to systems like speech recognition, but I don't think it's unique to speech recognition. It's common to any kind of hierarchical pattern recognition system where you have an ontonomy or an ontology. Some of you may be familiar with the term ontology, describing your problem space. And you need to adapt this ontology to new topics, to new environments, and things like that. Then I want to talk a little bit about discriminative feature mapping. Very little, but I just wanted to show you that what people are doing in efforts to actually adapt and transform the actual feature vectors using discrimination techniques. This is an area that emerged about 8 to 10 years ago, and it's really matured, and now just about every system does some form of this. And then I wanted to show you an example state-of-the-art system and just briefly talk about all the different types of adaptation that are done in that system to give you some idea of how these things are put to use. And then I'll leave, and you can have a 20 minutes or so to work on the course evaluations. And the papers, by the way, again, the papers are linked from the first page. Particularly, there's a nice paper on the example system that we're going to talk about, and that's available from our website. So to talk about language modeling, I have to go through a couple slides on how we decompose this speech recognition problem using Bayesian approach. So this is sort of my standard Bayesian formulation for speech recognition slide. I'd like you to draw your attention to this line, which says P of W given A is equal to P of A given W times P of W over P of A. So in the speech recognition problem, the general Bayesian approach is to try to maximize the probability of the word sequences, which we'll call W, given the acoustic vectors, which we call A. So you have a model, and we've talked about this now several times throughout the semester, that you have a model, and the model is essentially represented by the A, and you try to adjust the parameters of the model to maximize the probabilities of the words. And the way we do that is we use Bayes' rule to invert this probability and write it as the probability of the acoustics given the words times the probability of the words divided by the probability of the acoustics. The probability of the acoustics, this denominator term, is what we've been calling the evidence, and we typically ignore that during the optimization process. The probability of the acoustics given the words, that's our likelihood model. And the probability of the words themselves, this is what we essentially call the language model. So the probability of the acoustics of A given W, acoustics given word, we call this the acoustic model. And typically we use hidden Markov models, Gaussian mixture distributions, and things like that for that model. We won't talk about that today. We've been talking about that this semester and all the adaptation techniques we talked about when we were talking about how to adapt means and covariances and such were really targeted towards that model. But the model we didn't talk about is the P of W. This is what we call the language model, and this is where we essentially try to weight the measure, the P of A given W, by the likelihood of a word occurring. Now, P of W is a very interesting problem to deal with, because the structure or the shape of that probability distribution or the components of that probability distribution change pretty regularly. And I have a nice little slide that demonstrates that. And it's always nice to talk about that in the context of an election year, because elections bring out the introduction of all sorts of new terminology, and that causes a real problem for the PFW. But generally, you can think about this as we build some kind of a model that predicts acoustics from words, and then we weight that model by the frequency of the words. So words that are very common, words like articles, prepositions, and the like, are going to get a higher weight because they're more probable than words which are very uncommon, that words that maybe occur once in a million times and that kind of thing. So what I want to talk about today is a PFW. That's why you don't do animation with the touch screen. So I wanted to show this diagram. This is another view of the speech recognition process. This is really a view of what you might call a syntactic pattern recognition system. That's an older term for such a system. We have a signal that comes in. It could be speech, could be image, could be any other kind of data. We transform that signal into a sequence of vectors. We call that the acoustic front end. That's often called the signal processing part of the problem. A sample data signal goes in. What comes out are feature vectors, which are occur at a rate of maybe 100 times per second. We then convert those feature vectors to probabilities using our acoustic model. We compute this P of A given W. And that process is guided by the language model, P of W. So the language model, then, those probabilities are multiplied by the acoustic model probabilities, and then we go through a search process to find the overall most likely word sequence by looking at the probabilities of all possible word sequences and picking the sequence that's most likely. So this is essentially, this paradigm is not unique to speech recognition. This was actually first used in maximum likelihood decoding of bit patterns for communication systems in the 1960s, but it's been successfully applied to many, many disciplines, and it essentially provides a probabilistic mechanism for mixing knowledge about the domain, which we call our language model, and measurements of the signal, which we call acoustic models. It allows you to mix these two in a probabilistic space. Today we're going to talk about a little bit about how we adapt the language model, and then also how we adapt the feature vectors. So one more background slide on, two more background slides on language modeling. So the specific language models, when we first started, there were sort of two camps on how this was done. There was one camp that was building finite state machines that tried to construct machines that modeled every sentence that was allowable by the system, and as a state machine. So you could say things in some of the early applications of these systems. You could say things like, "Show me all available train routes from Boston to New York City on Tuesday, September 21st." And in the early days, we built language models that described those specific word sequences. Now, the problem with that, when you actually deal with real users, there's really two fundamental problems with that. I don't think any of you could say the sentence that I just spoke and get every word correct. In fact, you might say something like, show me all the trains, I think, from Boston to New York on, let me think, Tuesday, September 21st. Now, to build a state machine that models what I just spoke is much more difficult, because you have to allow disfluencies and all this other kind of stuff. And it was interesting, when we built systems like that early on, we would complain that the users just could not speak properly because they could not follow these complicated scripts. Well, that gave rise to the term habitable. Was the system habitable? Meaning, was the system easy for people to use? And we learned very quickly that it wasn't, because in those days, sort of a funny little story about this, the people funding this research tended to be military people. And very often, it was not uncommon every so often to do demonstrations for very high-level people, generals in the military and stuff. So they would try to use the system, and they would speak some sentence more like what I just described. Show me where my resources are, I think, over here. Well, you don't tell a general that he said he spoke incorrectly, right? Generals give orders, they don't take orders. So it became very clear that you had to make the system more flexible because your users were not about to change the way they behaved. So that gave rise to a different class of systems where we tried to model not the entire sentence end to end, but essentially the word combinations that go into that sentence. But we allowed for all possible word combinations so that users were not restricted in what they could say. And that's the way essentially modern day systems work. And those systems today are based on n-gram models. N-gram models try to compute the probability of a word sequence, and we show that word sequence as a sequence of W1 through WN. We try to simply model that word sequence as a product of the probabilities of the individual words. Now, we do that not by simply taking the probability of W1 times the probability of W2, but we actually try to model this as a Markov process, essentially. We look at the probability of W1 times the probability that W2 occurred given W1 times the probability of W3 occurred given W1, W2, and so forth. The reason we do this is because we want to model something about the way previous words can predict next words. But we don't want to model this exhaustively, because you'll see in a moment this is a very expensive term to model. So we can write this then as the product of these conditional probabilities, the product of the probability of the current word given so many previous words. Now, one of the things that makes the language problem very interesting is that estimating this function or this probability is very complicated, because think of how many possible word sequences there are in a language like English. Well, there's more or less an unlimited number. So we could never actually estimate this, because we need the word conditioned on all possible previous words. If you have a vocabulary of a common dictionary in English may contain something like 200,000 base forms, 200,000 words, and maybe up to 600,000 if you count all the variants of those. So if you have 600,000 words and you look at all possible ways those words can occur in pairs and triples and quadruples, this is an enormous space. It's trillions of possibilities. And if you go to estimate this, the language modeling problem is really interesting, because first of all, if you go to estimate that on a large chunk of data, suppose you go across the entire internet, and Google actually does this, and you look at every possible word combination you can find on the internet, you still cannot accurately estimate this for the case of maybe quadgrams or quintgrams, combinations of 4 and 5. You might get a decent estimate for combinations of 3. But even then, the estimate that you're getting is very specific to the type of language that's used on web pages, which is not the same kind of language that's used in conversational speech. Now, conversational speech has other challenges. When you're talking casually to somebody, you may think that you're very articulate, you're very smart, but it turns out you use only about 2,000 words. And I hate to say it, as you'll see in a moment, but most of those are things like, I know, yeah, mate, you know, those kinds of words. But what you do with conversational speech that makes it much more difficult is that you poorly articulate words and you introduce what we call disfluencies. You don't say, I'm going to the store today. You say, I think maybe I'm going to go to the store today. I don't know, maybe tomorrow. You use this kind of very free flow, unstructured type dialogue. And that makes it, that's very difficult to model with a language model, because most of what you're doing means any word such as uh-huh or yeah has to be possible at every point in the language model. And these are very short words, so they're easily confusable. So the power that you get out of language models trained on conversational speech is not as great, because the speech is very flexible. Almost anything is possible at any time. On the other hand, when you talk about an application like broadcast news, where announcers are reading prepared scripts, you can get more power out of the language model because they're following some formal sense of language. So at the end of today's class, we'll look at a system that was developed by DARPA to transcribe Mandarin broadcast news, Mandarin Chinese broadcast news. I thought I'd pick Mandarin since a number of you can relate to that, at least a number of them in class here. And it's really interesting to watch this system run. I don't have a demo of it today, but you can actually see it in real time decoding Chinese broadcasts and translating them into English. So you get parallel side by side, the Chinese and the English. And obviously for those of us who don't speak Chinese, this is a great thing because it allows us to sort of monitor Chinese newscasts without speaking Chinese. Does it work perfectly? No, but it's pretty decent actually. But that sort of introduces a third problem, which is what works in one language doesn't necessarily work in another language. The structure of language models in English are much different than the structure of language models in a language like Chinese. So this language modeling problem is very complicated, but generally what we found n-grams to work pretty well across most languages, whether they're n-grams of words or n-grams of phrases or n-grams of morphemes. Those kinds of details vary a little bit from language to language. But what we do, so the way we decompose this, so direct estimation of this conditional probability is not possible. So we actually cluster these, what we call word histories, the W1s through WI1. We try to essentially cluster those so that there's a finite, there's a reasonable number of terms in this probability that needs to be estimated. And the three simplest ways that we do that, we simply ignore the histories and just use the probability of single words. That's what we call a unigram model. And in that kind of a model, we're simply looking at how probable a word is to appear in the language without worrying about its context. We can also use a bigram model where we model essentially the previous word, the current word as a function of the previous word. Or we can use a trigram model, which is the current word as a function of the two previous words. Now, these are very powerful. These can actually work pretty well if you have enough training data. But there's some problems with this, and I'll demonstrate on the next slide. There's other ways to do this, though. You could actually merge histories based on linguistic context. You could, for example, ask for the probability of a word given its word class, like a noun or a verb or an adjective. You could cluster these things based on types of nouns. For example, the probability of a word like the color red, given that the previous word was an article, that kind of thing. So there are different ways we can cluster these histories, but the most effective way has been simply to use this n-gram analysis. Now, n-grams have sort of create some problems. And here's an example of that. This is some data that was, we computed about 10 years ago. We collected from 1991 to 93, we collected some data for a statistical language model. And this data was collected from two people talking over the telephone on prearranged topics. And we took that data, the data in total I think was about 6 million words, which was large in those days but very small today. And we plotted unigram distributions, bigrams, and trigrams. Now, the unigram distributions for, this was casual conversational telephone speech. The unigram distribution was pretty predictable. You had the most common words were words like I, and, the, you, the rank one, the 100th most common word were words like she, and, going. And then the least common words were names like Abraham, Alistair, Acura. When we looked at bigrams, when we looked at the most common bigrams, some obvious things came about. You know is the most common two-word sequence for this data, which is very common in casual speech. Sentences consisting of yeah. It's amazing how much people say yeah over the telephone. So if we actually determined, one of the interesting things that came out of this study is you could build a very simple speech recognizer which did nothing more than always guess the word yeah. Yeah and uh-huh, those are the two most common, I think, like single words. And you actually had a pretty decent chance of being correct. And in fact, some of the earliest speech recognizers we built, which did all this Markov modeling and stuff, gave error rates greater than 100%. They were wrong most of the time, like almost all the time. And they were much worse, using all this powerful statistics, than just guessing yeah or uh-huh. So that was kind of interesting. That was kind of discouraging, but eventually, you know, we got past that. But what's interesting is at the bigram level, when you look at the least common words, you started to see words like Reagan Bush. Now, think about that. This data was collected in 1991, 1992. That was during the Reagan Bush election. And I'll come back to that, because we're in an election year. When we looked into trigrams, you got some of the expected things, uh-huh, I don't know, a lot of was up there. But what's interesting is the least common trigrams, you start to see very specific things, like you've seen Brooklyn. And these, you start to see trigrams which are very, very specific to the type of data, to the domain, the topics and things. Now, when we started to process this data, we built systems, trained systems on this data, and by the late 1990s, we had pretty good systems. So we would field demonstrations of these systems and found out very quickly that they would fail. And the reason that they would fail is because by the late 1990s, common terms were more things like Clinton, more things like Gore. Those words did not actually even appear in this data in the early 1990s. Now, if you do that again, if you repeat that experiment today, you're going to see the words like Barack Obama, and you're going to see red states, blue states, all these kinds of terms that have become popular. I was reading the other day, there's a new word in the dictionary called MEH. This M, it's spelled M-E-H. And it's kind of it's one of these slang type terms, but it's become very, very popular. If you analyze the speech of high school kids, you will see them using this term MU now all over the place. So language modeling is a really good domain for studying adaptation, because adaptation is essential to language models. Language constantly evolves. If you build a system based on data collected many years ago, the system will not be relevant to today's language. You'll have a large error rate due to terms that have arisen in language within the last couple years. So language modeling systems try to continuously adapt over time, and that in itself poses a great challenge. Also, however, when you look at language models with trigrams, these become very specific to the domain that you're modeling. So if you train data based on data found on the internet, that may not be a good model for the way people speak over the telephone. If you train data based on, let's say, the internet, but you want to recognize speech in a medical domain, that may not be a good model. So you also have to adapt your language model to specific domains. And you would like to, the obvious way to do that would be to collect a lot of data in the new domain. You could go online and look at medical dictionaries and things like that. But even then, you don't have a model of the way people who would actually use the system would speak these medical terms. So you're always trying to adapt language models over time. You're always trying to adapt them for the domain. And then you have to smooth them, because when you look at when you talk about a language model that's maybe a quadram, four terms, even if you collect billions of words, you're not going to have all occurrences of every four-word combination that you need to recognize. It's very hard to get good estimates of all these words. So when you collect this data and you measure word frequencies, the distributions are going to have holes in them that represent words that could have occurred but did not occur. So you also have to do some kind of smoothing. And the way the smoothing is done, it's also done using an adaptation type approach, where you essentially try to interpolate across words that are close. So you may synthesize a trigram using a pair of bigrams for, if you have a trigram, which is three words, you could think of it as two bigrams. And you also sometimes mix in some domain language, and you do is really a maximum a posteriori adaptation, but we call it sometimes deleted interpolation, where you try to mix in some domain data that has the word combinations you're looking for, a small amount of that, with this large amount of data that you've collected from another domain. And the process of merging those two, as I'll show you in a moment, is also done using a fairly straightforward adaptation approach. So I mentioned all this just to get you sort of normalized to the language modeling problem. Now, the language modeling problem exists, like I said, in almost any pattern recognition application. If you're trying to do image recognition and you're trying to recognize vehicles and roadways and buildings and all this, you use a similar kind of language, and you have actually a similar problem that you have to somehow train the probabilistic model for how all these objects relate to one another. Fortunately, with language, people use language a lot, so we have a lot of this data online. With other applications, you sometimes don't, and that makes it even harder to train statistical language models for those applications.
From the figure, so the unigram is the best.
Is the best?
Yeah, because the convergence curve.
Yeah, okay, let me say a couple words about these. These are kind of interesting. So unigrams are the probabilities of one single word, right? And we all like to think that this is conversational telephone speech, right? So we all like to think we have big vocabularies and we speak really profoundly, right? Well, 80% of what you say is covered in 200 words when you're talking over the telephone. And to get up to 100%, you need to go out to 20,000 words. Now, that's interesting for two reasons. One, the number of words in your kind of most common set is very small. And those are usually things like I, me, yeah. But those words don't really tell you much about what you're talking about. The information content is scattered amongst these other 20,000 words that occur very infrequently. Now, if you remember, we were talking about Google searching by voice the other day. It's the same kind of a problem. Google's recognition system will recognize common words fairly well. But when you're doing searching, you know, last night I was searching for a language model adaptation on Chinese broadcast news. You know, some of those words are not so common. Yet those are really important to what I was searching for. And I was actually getting very bad hits. It was really frustrating on Google because I knew where the articles were, but I couldn't find them on Google. I had to go over to IEEE. So That's why the unigram distribution kind of rises very dramatically. This is sort of neither good nor bad, but this is expected. Now, the bigram distribution is, well, now you see that if your working vocabulary is 200 words, and if every word can follow every other word, the equivalent bigram distribution would be 200 times 200, right? Or 40,000. But not all words can follow every other word. So the bigram distribution reaches the 80 percentile point at 20,000, which is actually kind of interesting because it's about half of 200 times 200. So bigrams, a lot of words can follow other words, and these 200 most common words can follow one another. Only about half of them can't. So that actually means you're not going to get a lot of power out of this language model, because just about every one of these words can follow itself, right? So, and one of the interesting things about this, when we started this, we thought, well, we can build a language model where we will not allow the same word to appear three times in a row, because no one would ever say the same word three times in a row. Then we started to listen to the data, and guess what? We found people saying things like, and, yeah, that's right, I was thinking. So we threw that language model out quickly, because it turns out in conversational speech, people do all sorts of things. They will repeat a word, Tom, 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 can't you understand what I'm saying? It's Tom. You know, and so language modeling is really tough for that. So the bigram space is a little wider. There's only about, for this particular data set, there were only about 10, an order of magnitude more bigrams than unigrams. But the trigram space now just starts to explode. So with trigrams, we hit the 80 percentile point at about 400,000 trigrams. And 400,000 trigrams, again, is it's roughly 2,000 times 2,000, I think, if I got that right. But even this database actually is not large enough to support this kind of trigram analysis. So one of the arguments for this behavior with trigrams is that you're just showing that the database is too small. To estimate trigrams these days, people use billions and billions of words of text, which amounts to thousands of hours of audio data. Okay, so did that answer?
Yeah.
You don't get much power out of the unigram model. Bigram models for many years were popular because they gave you some improvement, but they were not computationally complex. Trigram language model is very much more computationally complex, so you have to do a lot of suboptimal search type things. So now to relate this to this course, so how do you go about, so you've built your language model across all of Google's web pages, and I come to you with an application. I want to allow people to do travel reservations on their cell phone. I want you to be able to, you know, call Travelocity up and say, give me a flight from Starkville to Washington, D.C. on Thursday. How do you go about building a good language model for this application? Well, you could just go and collect a lot of data for the new domain, but we've talked about why that's not a good idea. What would be much better is to try to mix the data you've learned from the internet with a small amount of data from the new domain. And guess what? Guess how we do that? The same old way. The LM problem is often described as an interpolation problem. You want to interpolate an old model and a new model. Any of the approaches we've discussed previously can be employed. Map adaptation has been very effective. Discriminative training works. You know, any of the techniques we've talked about can generally be applied. Map adaptation kind of boils down to mixing, I'm pointing to this equation with the alphas and the betas here, is mixing to, its amount, it's really a matter of mixing the counts from your in-domain data and your out-of-domain data, and that can be done using these alpha and beta weights. This is a sort of generalized form of map. If you make a few more assumptions, You can actually get it down to something which looks very familiar. You can have a lambda times your old probability, your old language model probability, plus 1 minus lambda times your new probability, language model probability. So this simply means that what you do for your language models is you essentially mix the old language model with the new language model, and you weight the corresponding probabilities. Now, this is not as easy to implement as it might look. It's a nice, simple, intuitive formulation, and this is essentially a map adaptation. You can actually show it's derived based on principles of map. But there's a problem that some word combinations may appear in the new domain that didn't appear in the old domain. So you have to be a little bit worried about that, because for some entries, you won't have one or the other term. And that's why this language model smoothing has to be done. And the language model smoothing is done using some very nice information theory approaches based on maximum entropy and such. And I won't talk about that too much, but there is an article, there's a link on the main page to a statistical language modeling paper that talks about some of these different approaches. Adaptation is critical to language models, and at a core, it's really just a matter of adapting a probability distribution. But like everything, because of this specific application, you have this big problem with unseen events in language and outlier behavior and things. So models typically must be smooth to account for the sparseness of the data. So in speech recognition field, there's people who work on acoustic modeling, there's people who work on language modeling. But both of them do adaptation. The details are a little bit different, but the general principles are the same. Now, another thing that we do in state-of-the-art systems these days is to actually transform features using a discriminative type transformation. And this is, I'm only going to say a couple words on this, because it really, it takes a lot more time to really explain why you want to do this. But the gist of it is as follows. When you collect your features, you might think about, could we find a transformation that separates speech sounds by adjusting the actual feature vectors? You could think of this as a pre-processing step where you look at the feature measurements associated with each sound, and you try to sort of separate those in a space, like a pattern recognition space. You still want to do all the stuff we do with Gaussian models and all that, but in addition to all of that, maybe we can get a little mileage out of actually trying to separate the features themselves before we process them with our pattern recognition technology. Now, early on, people were looking at things like support vector machines to do this, the so-called large margin classifiers, which are based on a principle that any two features, you can sort of separate features by rotating them into a high dimensional space. And the idea with this is that in the original space of the features, it may be hard to separate them. With a simple decision surface. So you might have features that are distributed in some strange way. And you might say, well, in this space, it's very hard to find some rule that will separate the features. But what I can do is I can transform them into some other space, typically a higher dimensional space, where they're now separable. And then I can draw a very simple surface to separate the two. Now, this is the principle of support vector machines. We talked about this a little bit in pattern recognition class. I just wanted to mention this here because that's actually the principle behind how we do the feature transformations. Instead of trying to simply transform the features in their own space,
We try to transform them into a higher dimensional space where they're now more separable. But we then take those higher dimensional space and can map it back down into the original space using this reduction transformation called M. So what's typically done in this approach is to find the H's that give you maximum separation in this high dimensional space, and then to train the matrix M using discriminative training type techniques so that in the original feature space you get some new features that are as separable as possible, that are better separated than the old features. And the details of this are beyond the scope of this course, but you can again think of this as a adaptation problem where this information is estimated on the adaptation set. And this information, the X's, come from your original space. So just like we can do straight up discriminative training, we can also use the same approach for discriminative-based adaptation of the features. And here I show a table which just sort of gives you some idea of the kind of benefit that you get out of this. As we walk down this table, we start with a baseline performance of 38%, and we go through some map adaptation, and we talked about MLE combined with map, and we get 35.4. We talked about discriminative training combined with map, we get 29.9. If you do this feature-based discrimination and then do map adaptation on top of that, you get 30.9. So you still get a reduction from the original, but it's actually a little bit worse than the discriminative training and the map. But then, of course, people have tried to combine all these things. You can do discriminative feature transformations with map adaptation, discriminative training with map adaptation, and then you get down to 28.6. This is a lot of complexity. I'm just showing you the kinds of improvements that are achievable. Does this make sense in most applications? I'm not sure. But it just shows you, gives you some sense for the kind of mileage you can get out of these approaches. In modern pattern recognition research, and this is a little bit depressing, but there's no big wins. And that's what I sent the article about the Netflix searching. I don't know if you had a chance to read that. It's really interesting. I mean, people have been working this problem now for like 5 years, and you know they measure their progress now in tenths of a percent. The leading group is, I think, at 9.4. They're trying to get to 10, and you know they spend 6 months to go from 9.4 to 9.5. And this people talked about the fact that what their final systems are very complicated, and they don't really understand them anymore. The software has gotten so complicated. Well, that's what this is. This is a state-of-the-art speech recognition system that transcribes Mandarin news broadcasts. And it's a concatenation of many, many different kinds of things. And I'm not, you know, I'll just briefly go through some of it. You start with your feature extraction. You take those features and you process them through vocal tract length normalization, which is a process of trying to normalize with respect to speaker characteristics. Then you do discriminative MLR adaptation on the features. Then you do speaker adaptive training and decoding. Then you do an additional speaker adaptive MLR modeling. Then you take those models and you again now repeat the process, but you do now some discriminative training and some more speaker adaptive decoding and with more speaker adaptive models. So it's not uncommon that with these kinds of systems, adaptation is used many, many different places. In a state-of-the-art system, you'll find adaptation used at least three levels of the system. And it's also not uncommon that you will bootstrap, you'll use adaptation on a first pass, and then you'll use the results of that pass to to do adaptation on the second pass. Adaptation is done on features. Adaptation is done on the acoustic models for the speaker. And adaptation is done on the language model for domain. Adaptation is done on discriminative training is done on once you're done with all the maximum likelihood passes, then you go back and do discriminative passes on everything. So, you know, many, many different things. And, you know, that the goal of these kinds of techniques every one of them, every one of these little things buys you, you know, like a small amount. So we start at 24.6, and you just kind of work your way down, 21.9, 21.7, 18.6, 18.5, and, you know, you just work your way down. And people have been doing this now for 10, 20 years, much like in the Netflix challenge, and every year, you know, there's a little bit of progress, but by the time, you know, you're a few years into this, the systems have been become so complicated that you cannot really go back and start them from scratch, because you're building on top of many, many years of modeling. And it's all adaption. Every year, you take your previous year's models and you adapt them with some new techniques, like just better discriminative training or something. So it's very hard at this point to go back and say, well, you know, if you give me the data, I can create the system from the scratch. They probably can't, because it involves many years of research to get them to that point. But I wanted to mention this just to show you that, you know, the second half of the course, we've really focused on adaptation the way it's being done today in modern pattern recognition systems. And the adaptation is done in a statistical sense on these parametric models, and it's used extensively. You can't look at a state-of-the-art system that doesn't do some form of adaptation today. So hopefully you'll get something useful out of this course as you proceed in your graduate studies. So that's all I wanted to talk about today. I wanted to leave you some time to do the course evaluations. But we've discussed really three things today: adaptation of language models, feature space adaptation, and then a little bit about state-of-the-art systems. And I think that we've covered a fair amount of material in this course. I don't know of many courses being taught around the country that have tried to teach these kinds of things. So hopefully you'll look back on this as a very unique experience.
After the adaptation, do they still use the same data for testing?
No. Very good. Very good question. Very good question. So, obviously, you could cheat, right? So, if you notice, whenever I show these slides, there's always something called eval and something called dev. The dev data is disjoint from the training data, but it's data that I give you with the answers so that you can do system development on the dev data. The eval data is just blind data. You process it, you send me the results. The results usually go to an organization like NIST, and then NIST scores them and presents the results at the conference. You're never allowed to know the answers for the eval data until the conference. So that means when you do adaptation on eval data, it has to be largely unsupervised, or you can do these iterations where you guess the transcription, adapt based on that, and then iterate, because you don't know the answer on the eval data. Now, people do try to tune their systems on the dev data, like adaptation parameters and things, hoping that that works well for the eval data. But you never know until you do the actual eval. You get one chance to do the eval, and then next year, the eval data is completely different. So we have this saying in our community that once you've run on eval data, it's no longer useful. It's because once you run on it and you see how your system performs, you can fix your system for that eval data. So eval data is always new. And that's why when, if I ever get a chance to sit through your dissertation defenses and I see you tuning on the test data, nope, that's illegal. That's cheating. Because in theory, given the power of these machines we use, you could always drive the error rate to zero on data for which you know the answer. But what you're concerned about is how well the system generalizes. So you'll notice 18% here, but 24% here. That's a big difference.
Does somebody prove there exists some bound in this system?
Another very good question. I was just reading a paper. I'm reviewing a paper for a conference that's coming up. And what struck me about the paper was this was a speaker separation task. Two people's talking, and you have to separate which words were spoken by which speaker. And what caught me, my attention about this paper is the performance of the algorithm is better than human performance. So generally, our upper bound on performance is human performance. And we do some tests to assess how well that is. And on complicated tasks, machines are getting within maybe a factor of two or so of human performance. But humans are still much, much better in noisy environments. As the data gets noisier, humans do much better. So we're still far away from human performance. But on some tasks, on some limited domains, machines can do as well as humans today. For example, credit card numbers. Have you ever tried to speak your credit card number to somebody over the phone? Machines actually do better than humans on that task, because humans just don't pay attention. They don't have long-term memory. The number of digits is beyond their sort of short-term memory. Machines don't have that problem. But on the other hand, have you ever tried to you call a company to get some computer support or something, and you get one of their automated systems, and it's a mess, right? You just, you know, get stuck in some crazy loop. And so, but the upper bound, there's a couple things we look at. One is human performance. The other thing we look at is productivity. We're beginning to take a very serious look at, can a computer handle more transactions per hour than a human? That's sort of a productivity-based measure. And there's some other measures like that that you can look at. Closed captioning, for example. There's a fair amount of closed captioning now that's done by a machine. Is it perfect? No, but people seem willing to tolerate it because more programs can be closed captioned. So sometimes performance accuracy isn't the only measure. Okay, so with this, I will leave the room and you can do the course evaluations. No, I don't, unfortunately. But maybe, are we short on pencils? How many pencils do we need? For our remote students, I'm assuming you get course evaluation sent to you through the college instructional system. If not, let me know and we'll get some sent out to you. Do we need a pencil? You wouldn't have to have a pencil. I can run upstairs and get some. Give me a second and I'll bring some pencils.
What's it on your
fail consistency?
12月6号。
几点？
星期六，没说时间。
他不是说12月9号吗？
12月6号。
哪12月9号？
12月6号。
那个星期六。
对 ，Saturday。
他叫你在哪看到的
？Cityverse。
我原来看 Cityverse 是5号吗？
6号。
那
我还专门来打印一下呀，那8号。
嗯，是啊。
什么东西啊？
布鲁斯那个8号。
那几点钟都没讲，在哪儿也没讲。
就得看看书了。他还剩最后一节课。
要啊，最后一节课不是那个 system。
这本课就好，后半部分的就行了。
应该是好就考。我听他那个意思。
啊。
我看他好就考后半部分。他说什么
？Three problem. The first come from the first and first half. The second come from the second half and the third.
March.
Comprehensive.
哦，语音还包括前面的。
第三。
哇。懂了。
哦。Finish。
Yeah, it's on the syllabus.
Yeah.
When?
I mean, unless, well, you know, we haven't talked about whether you want to move it.
No.
But, you know, I usually don't like to move final just because there's so much other scheduling that, where it's in this room, I believe. It's usually in the classroom that you take the course in.
Oh, so 8 o'clock?
Well, no, it's not. Is it 3 to 6? The time, it's on the syllabus. The university schedules the finals. I have no control over that. So whatever the time is on the syllabus, it should be correct. And that was scheduled at the beginning of the semester. So if that conflicts with some of your travel plans, I'm sorry. But and like if we want to move it up, you know, I'm willing to consider that. I don't really care either way, but I would hesitate to do that just because there's so many other conflicts involved. I think the final is in this classroom, right?
Normally?
Yeah. But it won't be broadcast.
Yeah.
And the rate, I don't know if the rate, well, I've already talked to all the students at Mozart that they don't have to come to the board. I'll send it to them. Okay, well, I'll see you guys on Tuesday. Have a happy Thanksgiving.
Tuesday.
全是最后一个。 写错，最后一个是 strongly disagree， 再查一下。哎呦，快一点！
好，挺正常，挺正常。
有空尽量不用。这个任务交给你了。
张浩，你就说别人搞事儿呗。
这样，你到我办公室去，把它交了。
哎，我后来看，如果要把那个第三问，用大图做出来，然后64乘64多人，32乘32多人，光那一问就做出30多人。
不用问，什么叫就是每个要找。
I knew I forgot something.